The CBS News Weekend Roundup, coming up next.
When you're opening a new office location, but deadlines don't let up, you need to make sure your team can start working fast, which means all of a sudden, you're looking to buy new conference tables, chairs, laptops, and whiteboards quickly. Business cards from American Express Open can give you buying power to help cover the big purchases you need to make when you need to make them. Find out how American Express cards and services can help prepare you for growth at open.com.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The first full week of the Donald Trump transition got off to a rocky start, but quickly picked up pace as the president-elect named an attorney general, a CIA director, and a national security advisor. But the country did not see or hear from Mr. Trump himself. For most of the week, he was holed away in Trump Tower, making decisions about his new team. We'll have the latest, including Chip Reed, on Mr. Trump's new chief strategist, Steve Bannon.
Before becoming chairman of the Trump campaign, Bannon was CEO of the conservative website Breitbart News, which earned a reputation for bashing establishment Republicans and promoting white nationalism.
And Hillary Clinton reluctantly comes out and speaks.
There have been a few times this past week when all I wanted to do was just to curl up with a good book or our dogs and never leave the house again.
I'm Howard Arenstein in Washington. First, President-elect Trump named Republican Congressman Mike Pompeo as the new director of Central Intelligence. Two other names may be more controversial: Michael Flynn as National Security Advisor and Jeff Sessions as Attorney General, despite Sessions' record of earlier attitudes about African Americans when he was a young prosecutor that kept him from being confirmed for the federal bench. With more, here's correspondent Major Garrett.
Jeff Sessions, senator from Alabama, the first senator to endorse Donald Trump, has been part of the Trump campaign and part of the conversations about the Supreme Court and other key justice issues since the November 8th election. And his selection as attorney general is a way for Trump to signal to conservatives that he's going to take not only issues of immigration very seriously, as he said during the campaign, but also issues of the Supreme Court. When Trump had a meeting earlier this week about who to nominate for that vacant position on the Supreme Court, the only non-campaign, non-family attendee to that meeting was Senator Sessions.
It's going really well.
President-elect Donald Trump has chosen retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn as his national security advisor, a job that coordinates military intelligence and diplomatic policy from the White House. Once a top intelligence advisor to generals in Iraq, Flynn, a lifelong Democrat, spent three decades in the Army. He co-authored a paper criticizing the intelligence community's strategy in Afghanistan. He retired in 2014, claiming he was fired as director of the Defense Intelligence Agency for the stand he took on radical Islamism. In the recent past, Flynn has called Islam a cancer and referred to it as a political ideology based on a religion.
Let's get off the dime and just call it like it is.
Islamic
extremism.
Flynn told Charlie Rose in early 2015 that President Obama's political correctness is one reason why America can't defeat Islamic terrorism.
Even in the Arab world, the Arab leaders, they will call it like it is. So why is it that the United States has such a difficult problem?
This weekend, Trump moves transition business to his New Jersey golf club. On the docket, a sit-down with 2012 GOP nominee Mitt Romney, who has blasted Trump in the past.
Donald Trump is a phony, a fraud. His promises are as worthless as a degree from Trump University.
Mitt Romney, in that piece by Major Garrett, who's said to be among the candidates for Donald Trump's Secretary of State. Now, correspondent Anna Werner reports on a key player in the Trump victory who could play a key role in the Trump White House.
Jared is a very successful real estate person, but I actually think he likes politics more than he likes real estate. I'm going to tell you.
Jared Kushner, son-in-law to the president-elect and husband to Ivanka Trump, has quietly exerted his influence throughout Trump's campaign. Wall Street Journal reporter Monica Langley.
He was the operational guru, but the more he stayed with Donald Trump, the more he became like the Trump whisperer.
While Mr. Trump was speaking with President Obama last week, Kushner was strolling through the Rose Garden with White House Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough. But Kushner's political aspirations came as a surprise to his friend, Sir Martin Sorrell.
And if I was his father-in-law, I would listen to him. I think he would provide a balanced opinion, which I think is important to anybody that holds an office like the presidency of the United States.
Kushner and his father-in-law may seem like polar opposites, but they have much in common, says Langley.
Both political novices, they are both real estate billionaires, and they both love Ivanka Trump.
And their fathers are both real estate moguls. 35-year-old Kushner took over his family's real estate company after his father was sentenced in 2005 to 2 years in prison for corruption-related charges. The person who put Kushner's father behind bars? Then U.S. Attorney Chris Christie.
Mr. Kushner engaged in a conspiracy with co-conspirators.
Christie was leading Trump's transition team until he was ousted. Some placed blame on Kushner. A Trump spokesman has denied that Kushner played any role in purging Christie or his allies. Still, Kushner's transformation from businessman to key political advisor may be complicated. Congress passed the anti-nepotism law in 1967 after President John F. Kennedy appointed his brother Robert to the post of attorney general. With or without an office in the West Wing, Kushner is likely to play an outsized role in the Trump administration.
Correspondent Anna Werner. One voice missing from the 2016 campaign was Jon Stewart, former host of The Daily Show. But he did sit down after the election with our Charlie Rose.
This fight has never been easy. And the ultimate irony of this election is the cynical strategy of the Republicans, which is our position is government doesn't work. We're going to make sure that it doesn't. But they're not draining the swamp. McConnell and Ryan, those guys are the swamp. And what they decided to do was, I'm going to make sure government doesn't work, and then I'm going to use its lack of working as evidence of it. Donald Trump is a reaction, not just to Democrats, to Republicans. He's not a Republican. He's a repudiation of Republicans. But they will reap the benefit of his victory in all of their cynicism. I will guarantee you Republicans are going to come to Jesus now about the power of government. One of the things that I think struck me odd about this election, and maybe I just missed it, was nobody asked Donald Trump what makes America great.
But do you think it's healthy that we have this now, that in fact this battle, this real sense of finding out who we are?
Yes, but I also
And whether we have gone off track in some way.
Absolutely. I would rather have this conversation openly and honestly than in dog whistles. You know, somebody was saying, there might be an anti-Semite that's working in the White House. And I was like, have you listened to the Nixon tapes? Like, forget about advising the president, the president. Like, have you read LBJ? Do you know our history? I thought Donald Trump disqualified himself at numerous points. But there is now this idea that anyone who voted for him has to be defined by the worst of his rhetoric. Like, there are guys in my neighborhood, like, that I love, that I respect, that I think have incredible qualities, who are not afraid of Mexicans and not afraid of Muslims and not afraid of blacks. They're afraid of their insurance premiums.
Jon Stewart of The Daily Show speaking with Charlie Rose. Coming up, the transition had some trouble getting started, and Hillary Clinton speaks out about her loss. Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Howard Arenstein. The Trump team got mired down this week with reports of a Stalin-esque purge and a knife fight over deciding who will fill important positions in the new administration. But correspondent Major Garrett says people close to the president-elect are denying the transition was in disarray.
Advisors insist stories of infighting and chaos are overblown, but agree. At times, this has all looked a bit amateurish. President-elect Donald Trump tried to sneak out of Trump Tower for dinner Tuesday after staff told reporters he was in for the night. His meal captured by fellow diners instead of the traveling press. Earlier, Mr. Trump and advisors met with Vice President-elect Mike Pence for more than 6 hours to get the transition back on track, discussing cabinet nominations and early legislation.
A lot of exciting things in the first 100 days of the Trump presidency.
Former Goldman Sachs partner and Trump loyalist Steve Mnuchin is the front runner for Treasury Secretary.
I've been in 80 countries, 150 different foreign trips.
Questions are being raised about Mr. Trump's leading candidate for Secretary of State, Rudy Giuliani, whose private firm reportedly held contracts with the government of Qatar. Giuliani has also given paid speeches to an Iranian opposition group that was once on the State Department's list of terrorist organizations.
You want to have a diplomat in charge of diplomacy. You don't want a bomb thrower.
After defense hawk John Bolton's name surfaced as another possible Secretary of State, Republican Senator Rand Paul objected, calling him unfit for the job.
I think Giuliani and Bolton are very similar. Bolton just has a more extensive cheerleading background with regard to war in the Middle East.
Kentucky Senator Rand Paul in that piece by Major Garrett. Donald Trump's campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway, on Thursday discussed much of the speculation on who will fill what post with Charlie Rose, Nora O'Donnell, and Gayle King on CBS This Morning.
The front page of the Wall Street Journal is reporting that Jared Kushner will likely get a top White House post. What does he want to do?
I spoke with Jared. He has not sought out a national security clearance. He has not applied for any job. But he obviously is incredibly important to his father-in-law, President-elect Trump, and was a big, big part of our election victory, frankly. Jared's been intimately involved with the campaign and the strategy from day one, and I'm sure that he and his wife and her brothers will continue to be very supportive. But time will tell in terms of the positions that different people still.
Traditionally, the president announces his national security staff first. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, her
yes.
lieutenant governor, told local reporters that she is under considerations to be Secretary of State. Is she on the short list?
Well, we have long short lists at Trump Tower in terms of transition. I think some people are expected on those lists, Nora, and some people would surprise you, would be unexpected. But this is what President-elect Trump is doing every day, meeting with advisors, having interviews with potential candidates for each of these positions. It's serious business. And I took a look yesterday at the timelines from past administrations, and we're basically right on target with respect to where other presidential administrations in formation have been, including President Obama's. And I very much appreciated what Vice President Biden said after his meeting with Vice President-elect Pence.
No administration is ready on day one. We weren't ready on day one. I've never met one that's ever been ready on day one. But I'm confident on day one, everything will be in good hands.
Is Rudy Giuliani, he's been very vocal about his desire to be Secretary of State. Is he a leading contender?
He's a leading contender for any number of positions. He's incredibly loyal to Donald Trump. He was very important during the campaign.
Are you concerned about his business connections that have been raised?
No, I'm not. And I understand that people want to vet things publicly. But again, we have a process that should be respected. And, you know, Gail, I just can't help but feel, whether it's the protesters or whether it's some of the unfortunate and, frankly, inaccurate headlines about some of the senior team and would-be cabinet members floating through the press. You know, Rudy Giuliani, if he was our Secretary of State, he would command a certain presence worldwide, but I think he's qualified for many different positions.
Donald Trump's campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway, on what will be. Now on what might have been, correspondent Nancy Cordes on Hillary Clinton's first post-election public appearance for one of her favorite charities, the Children's Defense Fund.
Clinton was greeted with a standing ovation and a kiss on the cheek from Marion Wright Edelman, the woman who hired Clinton right out of Yale Law School in the 1970s.
I will admit, coming here tonight wasn't the easiest thing for me. There have been a few times this past week when all I wanted to do was just to curl up with a good book or our dogs and never leave the house again. I know many of you are deeply disappointed about the results of the election. I am too, more than I can ever express.
She's been largely out of sight since her return to private life.
I urge you, please, don't lose heart. Don't give up on the values we share.
Democrats are trying to figure out how to promote those values now that Republicans will control both the White House and Congress. The new Senate Minority Leader, New York's Chuck Schumer, created new leadership roles for Vermont's Bernie Sanders and Wisconsin's Tammy Baldwin as the party tries to reach out to both progressives and Midwesterners. Clinton acknowledged that the base is still reeling.
I know that over the past week, a lot of people have asked themselves whether America is the country we thought it was. The divisions laid bare by this election run deep. But please listen to me when I say this. America is worth it.
The former Secretary of State didn't give any hints about what might come next for her. She did say that she wishes she could go back in time and tell her mother that her daughter would go on to win the majority of votes, about 62 million of them, in the race for president.
That from Nancy Cordes. And speaking of presidents, a CBS News correspondent who covered quite a few of them retired this week after more than 50 years in the news business. Here's the way Scott Pelley said goodbye to senior White House correspondent Bill Plant on the CBS Evening News.
Bill Plant? No, Bill's not here. That's shocking.
It certainly is. But after 52 years at CBS News, senior White House correspondent Bill Plant is calling it a career. And what a career. Covering every major story of the past half century, from the civil rights movement.
Have all the activities of the past weeks in Selma come to fruition now?
To the election of America's first black president.
Tomorrow they'll go into training.
Bill did four tours in Vietnam.
Did you make a mistake in sending arms to Tehran, sir?
No, and I'm not taking any more questions.
And covered the administrations of four presidents.
That was very impressive.
Politics, general assignment, writing, editing, reporting, air work, you name it, I'd like to do it.
Bill Plant came to CBS in 1964, and like a fine wine, he just seemed to get better with time.
Great color. Lovely light fruit taste.
So tonight we will toast our friend and colleague. You will be missed, Bill. Missed by millions.
Coming up, why all the controversy over the appointment of Steve Bannon as Donald Trump's chief strategist? And how will the Trump children fit into the new administration? Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Don't have time to keep up with the news? Try the CBS Radio News app on your iOS or Android device. You'll get the latest news as soon as you start it up. It's that easy. You can also listen to great programming like Face the Nation, the CBS Evening News, and the Weekend Roundup when you want it. You can even download them straight to your phone and listen later. It's all on the CBS Radio News app for iOS or Android. Download it today.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Howard Arenstein. CBS News contributor and Republican strategist Frank Luntz invited 18 Trump voters from New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut to take part in a focus group. Many of these people say they're mad as hell about the state of the country.
I hear about all these angry voters, millions of angry voters. You're them. What are you so angry about?
Barack Obama claimed hope and change, and for 8 years we basically got nothing.
The system. The system is rigged. Like he said, it's all against us.
What system?
Our government. Our government is against us. The people aren't representing
against
us.
Against you.
Yes, they're working against us. They're working for special interest. Everything has come down on the middle class.
We invited a bunch of women who didn't want to do it. Why would women not participate in this?
I think it's because of the whole sexual scandal. Because the backlash that I get is people say, how could you support someone that behaved in that manner? And that's not really what an election is about. We're not electing someone to be a Sunday school teacher.
How are we going to find common ground?
I think once Trump gets his mojo going, he's going to prove to everybody, Republican, Democrat, that he can do it and he's going to unite. We are going to come together. We have to.
But Donald Trump's first appointments to his incoming administration are raising concern, especially the naming of campaign CEO Stephen Bannon as his chief strategist at the White House. Correspondent Chip Reed explains why.
Stephen Bannon rarely appears on TV, but in political circles he is well known as a bomb-throwing leader of the anti-establishment branch of the Republican Party. Before becoming chairman of the Trump campaign, Bannon was CEO of the conservative website Breitbart News, which earned a reputation for bashing establishment Republicans and promoting white nationalism. On Capitol Hill, Democrats, including Betty McCollum of Minnesota, railed against Trump's decision.
His appointment of Stephen Bannon as chief White House strategist is proof of the ugly direction Mr. Trump intends to take this country.
In a statement, the Anti-Defamation League said it is a sad day when a man who presided over a loose-knit group of white nationalists and racists is slated to be a senior staff member in the People's House. The Trump campaign did not respond to our request to interview Bannon. Asked whether Bannon would bring white nationalist views to the White House, a Trump spokesman said, quote, "Nothing could be further from the truth, and it's irresponsible to even make such a baseless accusation."
Correspondent Chip Reed, before leaving for his final foreign trip to Greece, Germany, and Peru, President Obama held a news conference at the White House where he said it's important to give Trump a chance. Here's correspondent Jen Crawford.
Setting aside the harsh rhetoric of the campaign, President Obama struck a tone of conciliation.
Let him make his decisions, and I think the American people will judge over the course of the next couple of years whether they like what they see.
In other words, give him time.
Do I have concerns? Absolutely. Of course I've got concerns. You know, he and I differ on a whole bunch of issues.
After their meeting last week in the Oval Office, President Obama shared some impressions.
I don't think he is ideological. I think ultimately he's pragmatic in that way. And that can serve him well, as long as he's got good people around him and he has a clear sense of direction.
That's one reason he said he's hopeful Mr. Trump will preserve some of his foreign and domestic policies, including parts of Obamacare.
If they can come up with something better that actually works, I'll be the first ones to say, that's great. Congratulations.
Now, the president was asked specifically about Mr. Trump's decision to name campaign CEO Steve Bannon as his chief strategist. He said he is not going to comment on individual appointments.
That from Jen Crawford. Mr. Trump's children want to play a big part in the administration, but at the same time, correspondent Juliana Goldman reports there may be a potential conflict and is asking them to run his business, too. Though Mr. Trump denied in a tweet that he's trying to get top-level security clearance for his children.
CBS News has learned Donald Trump's transition team is exploring how the president-elect's children could receive top-secret security clearances. While nepotism rules prevent a president from hiring family to work in the White House, relatives could still serve as unpaid national security advisors with access to the nation's top secrets. The unprecedented request adds to other ethical questions, like how will Trump separate his administration from his business that's now run by his children?
The laws are very soft on this whole matter. I don't have to do anything.
There are no rules to prevent conflicts of interest for presidents, but historically, they've chosen to put their investments in a blind trust.
A real blind trust would be one where he picked a third party to manage his investments. He would not know what's going on there.
Ethics watchdogs like Larry Noble say Trump's setup doesn't pass muster.
What that is just turning your business interests over to people, your family, which is very close to you.
The arrangement doesn't solve conflicts like Trump's relationship with Deutsche Bank, to which he owes more than $300 million. The bank is in multi-billion dollar settlement negotiations with the Justice Department for trading in toxic mortgages. Those talks could last into the next administration. There's also Trump's new hotel in the old post office building in Washington, which is leased from the federal government.
Even the tenants in his buildings pose a conflict, like the state-run Chinese bank that's paying rent to lease space on the 20th floor of Trump Tower. It means a foreign government is putting money in the hands of the president and his family.
That from Juliana Goldman. And now correspondent Nora O'Donnell on the death of prominent journalist and broadcaster Gwen Ifill, who broke new ground as an African-American woman.
I'm Judy Woodruff.
And I'm Gwen Ifill.
When Gwen Ifill joined Judy Woodruff in 2013 to form the first all-female national network anchor team, it wasn't the first time she broke through barriers in journalism.
I have a flat spot right in the front of my head from trying to break down walls my entire career, forcing diversity of thought and opinion into newsrooms and onto the air.
Her career brought her to the Washington Post, where she covered her first of seven presidential elections, and then the New York Times, where she covered the White House. In 1994, she made the jump to television, joining NBC.
And to our new senior correspondent, Gwen Ifill. Welcome, Gwen.
Thanks, Jim.
In 1999, she moved to PBS, where she spent the rest of her career, which included multiple stints moderating debates and the historic 2008 election of America's first African-American president.
The Obama campaign provided a frame for a story. It turns out I've been writing my whole life.
She was an especially powerful role model for young women and girls who admired her integrity, her tenacity, and her intellect.
President-elect Trump echoed those sentiments in a tribute on his Facebook page. Gwen was a broadcasting pioneer, shattering barriers throughout her career. Her words to Charlie Rose in 2009 are especially poignant today.
And your hopes for Barack Obama?
My hope is the same I would have for any president. Right. I think you always hope for a president to succeed, and there's too much at stake for him not to.
Gwen Ifill, dead of cancer at the age of 61.
Please follow us on Twitter for the latest headlines at CBS Radio News. And I'm at Dan Revive on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Howard Arenstein. From Maine to California, with the exception of Arizona, marijuana initiatives were approved by voters across the country, and pot has become a billion-dollar business. Charlie Rose spoke recently on CBS This Morning with Dr. John LaPook, our medical correspondent, who went to Colorado to check out how that state is dealing with legalization.
Marijuana use is still illegal under federal law, but 57% of Americans believe it should be legal. For 60 Minutes, our chief medical correspondent, Dr. John LaPook, investigates the impact of legalizing recreational marijuana in Colorado.
There's huge differences between alcohol and marijuana, and that's one of the things the public really needs to understand, is they think, well, we can take all the rules and everything we've set up for alcohol and just transfer them over, and they can't do that.
Right. Dr. Marilyn Hustis, former chief of chemistry and drug metabolism at the National Institute on Drug Abuse, has been studying marijuana's effects on the human body for more than 25 years.
When you take alcohol, it has its effects, and then it leaves the body. When you take cannabis, it gets into the tissues of your body and is stored.
It can be stored in the fat.
It's stored in the fat.
How about in the brain?
And the brain is a very fatty tissue. And so we know that it's still in the brain when you can no longer measure it in the blood.
Colorado law says anyone with 5 nanograms per milliliter or more of THC in their blood can be arrested for driving while impaired. But by the time a police officer gets a suspect back to the station and tests their blood, the marijuana can be out of their bloodstream. Roadside oral swab tests for marijuana are now being evaluated by Colorado police. So far, Colorado has not seen a huge spike in marijuana abuse by teens or in driving while high. But the data is still being collected on pot's overall impact on the state. All these issues sit on the shoulders of Governor John Hickenlooper, who was originally against the legalization of recreational marijuana.
My biggest concern is that we're not collecting data. And what I've told other governors is don't wait for the laws to change. Start collecting baseline data now. How many kids are using marijuana? Start looking at accidents. Was there THC involved? So that we really have good baselines so that as we accumulate more data, if they do legalize it, we can see what the effects of legalization itself really are.
Dr. John LaPook joins us now. So after this, I mean, what conclusions have you reached? Because as you just said, there is no test.
Yeah.
There's no breathalyzer.
There's no the equivalent of a breathalyzer for alcohol. You can't. It's hard to tell if you're driving while stoned. So for me, you know, the reason why 60 Minutes went to Colorado is we wanted to go to the place where there's the most experience with it, because it looks like, as we said, that most Americans do want it to be legal. And if it's going to be legalized, we need to find out, you know, how to do it the most responsible way. And Governor Hickenlooper said to me, what are the guardrails here?
So he's gone from opposition to let's see.
To let's see. And then when you go there and you speak to doctors and you speak to cops and you speak to scientists, you realize there are so many questions. This is so tricky, which is why we've learned so much when we went to
Colorado. So what more needs to be done, John, to really understand the effects of recreational use and medicinal use?
Well, for one thing, as Governor Hickenlooper said, we need to start getting data now. So one of the problems that they had in Colorado was, yes, they were able to measure in babies, for example, newborn babies, marijuana in the system. There have been a slight increase that they've measured of fatal car crash where they find marijuana in the driver. But is that a change? They don't have any good baseline data, so don't know, is that a change?
And you said you asked Governor Pence about this, and he said been no discussion in the campaign trail.
Yeah, he said very little, and I think it's slipping under the radar.
Our medical correspondent, Dr. John LaPook, speaking with Charlie Rose. Now here's Dan Revive.
More reaction to the election of Donald Trump? Let's hear from the president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation, Colin O'Mara. I'll be frank, Mr. O'Mara. A lot of people think that environmentalists are overwhelmingly liberals, which would mean that your candidate lost on Tuesday and the other side won. Is that the way you see things?
No, and actually the National Wildlife Federation has as many Republican members as it does Democratic members. And if you look at the debates and you look at the speeches, there's only about two areas where the candidates agreed, and it was infrastructure And it was the public lands, basically, that getting folks outdoors, protecting wildlife matters. And so we actually think those two places where we completely agree with both candidates could be a place to actually begin healing some of the divides that we're seeing across the country.
In any way, if the new president wants to push for infrastructure, that could mean a lot of construction projects. That's not always good for wildlife.
But what we see is also it's a way to improve water quality. It's a way to invest in cities, which then reduces pressure on sprawl. And there's also a lot of natural infrastructure. I mean, there's things like, you know, cleaning up contaminated brownfield sites so they can be redeveloped. There's things like restoring, you know, wildlife habitat and improving trails and things like that in our parks and in our wildlife areas and increasing hunting access. And so there's a whole lot that kind of falls in a potential infrastructure package. And then a lot of it's going to be supported by, you know, sportsmen and, you know, folks that just love the great outdoors if it's a comprehensive package like the president-elect has proposed.
And I'm listening to sportsmen go out. Some of them hunt. Some of them like their guns. They love the countryside. Now, I am thinking that it's so-called red areas on the political map. So, to be frank, what do you think when it comes to folks who care about wildlife and certainly who join the National Wildlife Federation? Truly, you're saying truly Republicans, Democrats about even?
Yeah, so I mean, I was out pheasant hunting last week. We got as many hunters and anglers as we do, you know, bird watchers and, you know, backyard gardeners. And, you know, a lot of them just want to help save the thousands of species right now that are in trouble. They want to have, whether it's, you know, to go duck hunting or to go, you know, watch songbirds, you know, folks want to make sure there's investments in these things. And frankly, some of the best places to invest are the very same districts where you're going to need votes from both parties in the more rural areas to actually get a package passed. So it could be a political home run.
And the projects that you would favor, would you say Congress has been too tight with the purse strings in recent years? That's certainly what we hear. Congress doesn't want to spend money where it's not deemed necessary. Have you felt challenged?
Yeah, there's broad bipartisan support, but, you know, for things like, you know, the state wildlife grants program, they spend about $60 million that's spread across all 50 states. It's a blip on in the bigger budget. And so, you know, making those kind of investments that help underpin the $646 billion outdoor economy that, you know, get folks out enjoying America's amazing natural resources, we think is a great place to actually pick up a lot of votes as part of a bigger package.
You know, it strikes me, Mr. O'Mara, that means that it's not just about jobs. You're also pointing out that Americans like to relax and get out there. Or you're going to say that the things you favor are good for jobs, too?
No, they're good. I mean, it's like if I can spend $1 million on different types of construction, I can actually put more people to work if I'm investing in natural resources, building trails, building duck blinds, restoring habitat, because there's less money that goes into capital equipment. There's less money that goes into kind of physical assets. And so it's actually a way to put a ton of people to work. So right now, more than 6 million people work in the outdoor economy. I mean, if you invested a few $1 billion in enhancing those assets and giving more people the opportunity to go outdoors, you could put, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people to work.
What made you say $6 billion? Is it your understanding maybe Trump would favor that?
He's proposed that his package would be roughly twice the size of Secretary Clinton's. She was proposing about a $25 billion package. He's thinking more like 50. And so we're proposing, you know, trying to spend about 10%, a little more than 10% of that on natural resource projects across the country that help improve the resilience of communities and create a lot of outdoor opportunities for folks.
The president of the National Wildlife Federation, Colin O'Mara. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
More just ahead on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Get the latest information when you want it. Download the CBS Radio News app, either on iOS or Android. You also get great features, breaking news, and access to the CBS Radio News Twitter and Facebook feeds. Learn about your world while you take care of all the things you need to take care of. It's perfect for the gym, running errands, or doing chores around the house. CBS Radio News. Get it in the Apple App Store or Google Play today.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Dan Raviv. Now a story that's about the volatile Middle East and also about a volatile life. The author is Salome Anderson, who joins us now. Your book is called The Hostage's Daughter, and it's not a novel. It's your story. It says a memoir of family, madness, and the Middle East. Salome Anderson, you're the daughter of Terry Anderson, who was, like me, a foreign correspondent. He worked for the Associated Press. And in 1985, in Lebanon, he was kidnapped, apparently by the Shiite Muslim militia called Hezbollah. He was held for 6 years. And Salome, first, just remind us, you weren't even born yet, right? You were born after your father was kidnapped.
That's right. I was born 3 months after he was kidnapped.
So the first time you ever saw him, you were 6 years old after he was released.
That's right.
Well, relive that moment. I know it's just a moment, but obviously one that's either good, bad, scarring, doesn't leave you. You know, seeing your father for the first time after knowing that your mother was, of course, campaigning for his freedom. What was that like?
Well, it's obviously one of the clearest memories of my early childhood. So I fell asleep on a couch at the American University in Damascus. I just remember this like thin, pale man waking me up, and he said, "Hi, I'm your father." And he didn't look like how I had imagined him to look. I don't remember if I answered him or if I even said anything. I think I just kind of stood there with my mouth open. You know, I do remember him taking me by the hand, and we walked out into this crowd of people just screaming and yelling and, you know, taking pictures, and it was just circus. And one of my clearest memories is that I remember his hand shaking in my hand, and I looked up at him, and he had this big smile on his face, but he was clearly very uncomfortable with the noise and the lights. And I just remember thinking to myself, something very bad must have happened to him.
Now you're 31 years old. You're a journalist. It says you're based both in New York and Beirut. What? The city where your father was kidnapped? I mean, it's just not so dangerous anymore? Or you felt drawn to be there?
It is both not as dangerous as it was when my father was working there. And I did feel drawn to my father's career because I think for a lot of reasons, just, you know, by nature, it's a career that makes sense for me, for my, you know, my characteristics, my talents, things like that. But also because on some deeply subconscious level, I think I really just wanted to make my father proud of me by excelling at a career that he had excelled at. You know, I felt instinctively, and I believe I was right, that it would give us some common ground, something to bond over.
And you think you're right about that. Okay, and most of that is bright and positive, but your book, The Hostage's Daughter, also says you went through a really rough patch. What, drug abuse, your father's PTSD? How many years were really bad?
By the time I would say from prepubescent well into my 20s, it was pretty rough. There was at least a 12 or 13-year stretch where I don't believe I was ever off the influence of some sort of substance, or if I was, it wasn't for very long. And, you know, I was diagnosed with a mental illness in my early 20s. I was suicidal. I was in abusive relationships. It got really bad for a while. And I tell that story mostly because people should know that events like what happened to my family, they don't just sort of disappear or evaporate when the cameras go away. These political events have human consequences that continue for years.
And your father, is he okay? What is he, nearly 70 years old now?
Mm-hmm, yeah, he's doing well. He's retired. He lives in Virginia. He's healthier and happier than I've ever seen him.
The author of The Hostage's Daughter, she lived it, still does, Salome Anderson. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now an espionage story you actually might not have heard about, because a key part of the story took place right around the time of 9/11 and another part just as the U.S. was invading Iraq in 2003. But a science writer, and that's really how I know you, Udijit Bhattacharjee, has everything about this story. In a new book called The Spy Who Couldn't Spell, it's not just about science, but, you know, this man, this American, who has been convicted for stealing U.S. government secrets. One thing that's fascinating to me, Mr. Bhattacharjee, is that he hid the documents. He buried them in parks around Washington, D.C., and then wrote himself notes in code. I guess that's what got you interested in the story, too.
That's exactly right, Dan. I was fascinated by the specifics of the plot that was masterminded by this particular traitor named Brian Regan. He stole the secrets, he sorted them, he made packages, and then buried them in two state parks, and then encrypted the geo-coordinates of all the hiding locations, which he was then going to pass on to a couple of intelligence services in exchange for $13 million.
Now, why is your book called The Spy Who Couldn't Spell? I mean, that has something, I think, to do with a letter that he wrote to a foreign embassy offering to sell the documents, and that letter was filled with spelling mistakes?
Brian Regan was severely dyslexic growing up, so he was terrible with spelling. What Brian Regan did was he went to great pains to write encrypted letters to a couple of embassies that he then mailed the letters to. These letters were filled with spelling errors, and in fact, that was one of the clues that the FBI investigators used in order to track down the spy.
And this man, Brian Regan, worked for the NRO, not very well known, but part of the U.S. intelligence community, the National Reconnaissance Office, and they run the military satellites that go all around. I mean, prosecutors said that the potential damage was huge. Did they ask for the death penalty?
They, in fact, did ask for the death penalty, and it was only the second time in 60 years that U.S. prosecutors asked for the death penalty to be given to a traitor.
Brian Regan got a life sentence. That's what he's serving now. But the last part of your book is really interesting, because when he had nothing left to lose, he did help the government and help them unravel his very personal code.
After he was arrested, the case should have been over, but Brian Regan decided that he wasn't going to tell the government exactly what he had done. And so federal investigators spent close to a year trying to determine what he had taken and where he might have hidden all of the stuff that he had taken. They were not successful on their own, and it was only after his conviction that they were able to persuade Brian Regan to cooperate. Unfortunately, it had been so long since Brian Regan had come up with his complex codes that he forgot the key to his own code when he sat down to try and decode what he had encrypted.
The title of the book, The Spy Who Couldn't Spell, as it says, it's about a dyslexic traitor. That's the author, Udijit Bhattacharjee. Thank you very much, Udijit.
Thank you so much, Dan.
Our thanks to you for listening. Anytime you want to hear us, including previous episodes, please do a web search for CBS Weekend Roundup. And remember our app for your smartphone. The free app is CBS Radio News. The Weekend Roundup is produced in Washington by Howard Arenstein. Have a great week. I'm Dan Raviv, CBS News.